Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for TWiT specials is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is TWiT special number 49, recorded November 17th, 2010. Kevin Kelly, what technology wants. I'll do what there I used is. To do when I did a radio show, which is I'll read from the back page.
Yeah.
Kevin Kelly helped launch Wired magazine and was its executive editor for 7 years. He's written for The New York Times, The Economist, Science, Time, and The Wall. Street Journal.
The Wall.
I have Roger Waters on the
line. I thought
you
were saying The Well, and then realized that you were going to keep going.
And The Wall, Street Journal. Among many other publications, his previous books include Out of Control and the best-selling New Rules for the New Economy. He lives just down the road from us in Pacifica, California. His website, and you can tell he's an old-timer, is kk.org. Hey, Kevin. It's good to see you.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Welcome to the show. It's very informal, very relaxed. You can wave at all the peeps.
Hey, here I am.
Hey-o.
Last time I saw you was at Food Camp.
Yes, that's right.
And I was
Isn't
telling
that a wonderful invention?
God, that was so much fun. It's probably like Fight Club, which is that I'll never get invited back because now I've mentioned it or something. But it really is a great time. And you and Stephen Levy did a little workshop on slow news.
That's right.
I enjoyed that.
That was his idea.
Well, both of you are working on books that have taken you a while, right?
Exactly. Yeah. I worked on mine for 8 years. He's been working on his for years. He's in a race to be on top of things. I'm trying to get to the bottom of things, so I'm not as in a hurry.
But neither of you, and I think this is the kind of the point, neither of you are like bloggers where it's like a, you know, what's the news cycle? 12-minute news cycle for blogs these days?
That's correct, or 12 seconds for Twitter.
Yeah, instantaneous.
Hey, Kevin, Tom Merritt here. I'm joining in on the conversation. I've had a chance to peruse the book. I haven't read it all the way through, but I was really impressed in your introduction where you talked about how little tech you use, but you don't have a problem with it. You just sort of use what you need.
Yes, I have a great affinity for the Mennonites. The Mimimonites.
You almost look like a Mennonite.
Yes. I'm trying to minimize the amount of technology in my life by carefully selecting those tools which suit me and kind of forgetting about the rest. Of course, that entails me trying everything at least once to see if it works. Like, for instance, Twitter does not work for me. TV doesn't work. The internet does work. Email does work. But that actually is not unusual for even the Amish because they, you know, they have their horse and buggy, but at the same time, they use disposable diapers. They've got chemical fertilizers. They've got genetically modified crops. So
you cleared up a mystery for me. I had seen Amish people riding in cars before, and you explain how there's no prohibition of them getting in a car. They just can't drive it. They hire somebody to drive them around. And explain about these compressed air generators, how they, yes. they actually are able to use machines, powered machines.
Right. So the typical, stereotypical image of the Amish is that they're Luddites, that they're kind of anti-technology, but I actually found them more like hackers, tinkerers. The pneumatic hoses in their houses are what they jokingly call Amish electricity. So there's a huge diesel-powered compressor in the barn, and it's making compressed air, and they send it through these hoses, mostly into the workshops, but some into the homes. And they have a whole smaller industry that converts electrical appliances into air-powered appliances. Like, so you can get your blender, your washing machine, your sewing machine run on compressed air. And so for them, what are they gaining by this? They two things. One is they say that these appliances are longer lasting, they don't burn out, which might be true. But mostly they're separated from the grid. And the grid for them is a sign of kind of being at the demand and connected to the world. And so for them, this works because they are trying to lead separate lives.
It reminds me of Orthodox Jews who do the same thing for Sabbath. Right. Have all sorts of bizarre, but it always struck me as kind of a little bit. Is it a religious for the Mennonites? Is it a religious interdiction against technology?
No, it's not. And that's the interesting thing, is because I discovered that, in fact, what they are optimizing is actually leisure. That actually doing things is kind of slightly off-kilter, slightly more menial, manual way actually gives them far more leisure than we have. And
damn them. I knew there was a trick. This technology.
All these time-saving devices that we have are not saving us any time.
Isn't that interesting?
Not at all. And what these devices give us, which the Amish don't have, is increased choices, possibilities, and opportunities. So the Amish actually have optimized leisure. They have optimized the kind of unity of their family and their community, strong community bonds. But they've done that at the price of giving up the choices of what they can be. So if you're a girl Amish, you have one destiny. You're a mommy. That's
okay.
If you're a guy, you're going to be either a farmer with your working with your dad, or maybe a guy who makes things, some furniture in the barn. That's it. There's no mathematicians. There's no musicians. There's no professional painters, photographers. So they optimize leisure, centeredness, satisfaction to some extent. And they pay the price of decreasing their options.
I can absolutely believe that, because what you get with technology now is you don't have to wait, right? We get broadband. We want faster things. So there's no waiting around for something. There's no slowly grinding the coffee in the morning. Right. You have got the automatic grinder, does it for you, and then you're on the way to have to doing something else. Or even having a DVR, like a TiVo, you're actually saying, I'm not going to miss a show and say, you know what, that time was used for something else. I'm going to have to go watch that show at some time. And so I will never lose that time.
That's correct. And I think we have traded those kinds of things for the possibilities that we could do whatever we want. Although the price of that is that we're going to be forever scattered. It's going to be kind of very superficial. It's going to be very complex. We're going to be always uncertain about who we are. And then we seem to actually, want to live that way.
Are those necessary correlatives, though? I mean, do you have to have that fractured life if you indulge in technology to the degree that we indulge?
Well, I think, and this is what I'm trying, I think that we can, by selectively choosing certain technologies that really resonate with us and our abilities and our talents, and then try to ignore the rest, that I think we can have a better chance of making some compromise in there and somewhere in between, where we're not completely like a balloon, very large, kind of thin and inflated, but they actually have some
substance.
Depth.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
No, but I feel the pain of this lifestyle you just described, Tom. I certainly feel the pain of it. It's an occupational hazard for us, because what we do is cover technology. Although, Kevin, you do that too. Did you? I mean, is this something that you came to after years at maybe Wired magazine and years as being a technologist? You said I've got to find another way.
Well, actually, I sort of started off as a hippie who dropped out of college, who went to Asia
for 10 years. Not just went.
Yeah.
You stayed there.
Right. Yeah. And I got a really bad case of optimism there. And
was that a mistake?
Yeah, I guess so.
There's but tears for that.
There are, yeah. Calcutta. And I came back, rode my bicycle across the U.S., and I was really interested in when I went and moved to California. I was 35. I not had a real job. I owned a bicycle and a sleeping bag. But I was interested in this Holworth catalog, which was a pool of people, actually. It was kind of like a Web 2.0 community before there was a web, mm-hmm. 20 years before there was a web, of people who were kind of user-created recommendations of great tools. And what they were doing is trying to select the appropriate technology. And I was really interested in sort of getting the few things that I thought could work. And that was going along fine until, basically, I plugged my computer into the phone line. And then I discovered, oh, my gosh, there is another country there. I had been writing about travel and been covering foreign, travel guides and how to travel. And then when I plugged the computer into the phone line and saw the first emergent online world, I started to write about it as if it was a foreign country. And
I remember that feeling very well. I was on the Well as well. And the Well was a messaging system, but it was on top of Unix. And you could drop into a Unix shell on it. And I remember doing that. And it was probably late 80s because I launched Lynx, which was a text browser. And I was stunned. It was the first experience I'd ever had of the broadness of the world, of how many people there were. And this was early days. I mean, it's, of course, much worse now.
Yeah. And there was a lot of that selectivity that you're talking about happening naturally on the internet at that time because not everybody used it.
Right. And I think what was interesting was that I think until that point, I had had an idea of technology as sort of most maybe people did as sort of being inhumane, kind of concrete. I mean, computers were these big things that were going to do not fold or staple, you know, you had to obey it.
Yep.
And there was definitely a sense of, you know, I was a hippie. I'd kind of dropped out of the system. But I think what happened on the Well and these online places was that for the first time, I saw a different facet, a different face of technology. It seemed to me to be much more organic, much more convivial, much more at the scale of humans. And the communities that were forming there reminded me of these, you know, communities I had been living in the third world, or even the Amish communities. And so I began to kind of, because I was viewing technology differently, I began to go back and look at, you know, my assumptions about technology and, you know, was realizing that, it was bringing us things that were really good. And so I then, as, you know, Wired came along and I started to report on this, I had two ideas about technology. One was that I wanted to keep it to a minimum, and the other one was I want to maximize it for others. And I think my writing the book was my quest to investigate this, because I realized that there was no theory about technology. I had no framework to put it in. But technology was basically one thing after another, and it has to be more than that. So
it is. It's like life.
Yes.
It's one thing after another. Yeah, I think in a way that's, you were noticing, I had that same feeling of, I wasn't interested in big computing, but once it became personal and once it became social, this was very early social computing, wasn't it? Yeah.
The whole Earth catalog itself was basically social media run on newsprint.
Yeah.
So if you read some of the old stuff from the Whole Earth Review and the Whole Earth Catalog, they were basically blog entries.
They were
enthusiastic, passionate, very, very sort of inspiring and very detailed. And but we were running it on newsprint, and that same quality of passion and enthusiasm is present now on the web forever, everywhere. But that was what we were kind of channeling through these primitive tools at that time.
You talk in What Technology Wants about the recentness of the word technology, and you make a distinction between technology and technium. Can you explain that, or the technium, I guess?
Yeah. So the actual concept that we were dealing with more than just a series of artifacts, more than just one thing after another, came actually very late. And the first resurrection of the ancient Greek term, which was never really used, was done in Germany by a professor who was putting together a curricula for a course of studies. And he took all the, what they called applied arts at that time, they didn't call them technology, it was like architecture, metalworking, blacksmithing, chemistry, mining. And he says, there's something, they have all these things in common. And he called it Technologie in German. A few years later, Jacob Bigelow at Harvard imitated him and did the same thing. in the U.S. in English, and he called it technology. And that's actually 1829, the first use of the term. It's like the first time we gave it a name. And what the it is that we're giving a name to is not just culture. It's not just this collection of things that we've made. It's not just the phone in your pocket and the vacuum cleaner. It's the fact that all these items and infrastructure are totally interdependent and coexisting with each other. So your phone might require 1,000 different intermediate technologies to produce it and keep it operating. And that ecosystem of all those things, that kind of super organism, is actually what I call the technium. And the reason why I give it a new name is because, unlike, say, just a collection of stuff, it actually exhibits a system effect. It actually exhibits a behavior at the level of the system that's not present in the iPhone and the vacuum cleaner and the electrical wires.
Is the interdependence of these things the key?
Yes. It's the fact that they form a web, a kind of co-evolutionary web in which there's, you know, technology A causes or creates technology B, which is necessary to make technology C, which is necessary to make technology D, which makes technology A. So you have this sort of recursive infinite loop, circular loop, and that supports everything, and this gives it, whenever you have recursive strange loop, it gives these systems some inherent bias so that they kind of fall into some patterns. And that's the pattern that I call want. I don't mean technology wants something or the technium wants something the way that you or I would want it, but I mean like the way the tomato plant sitting on your windowsill wants light and it leans toward it. And so I'm asking, well, what does a technium lean towards?
It's a self-organizing system in a way?
Yes. It's a self-organizing system, and because it is, it actually is an extension of the same evolutionary force that has produced all life on this planet. I mean, you know, that's what life is. Life is a self-organizing force that continues to make itself more complex, and the technium is an extension and acceleration of that very same force.
I always thought of technology more as neutral, though, that we shape it. So you're saying it shapes itself, in effect.
Well, you know, it's really funny because we don't say, you know, for every birth, there's a death in life.
Right.
Therefore, life must be neutral.
Right.
No, we say life is good. And I think the same thing about technology. I mean, every new thing that we invent, we'll bring with it almost as many problems as solutions. And
that's what I mean by neutral, is that it doesn't have an inherent – most technology, I mean, a few technologies kind of have an inherent good or bad, but most of the time they're essentially amoral or neutral.
Yeah, it's a tool that we use.
But that's not the case.
No, actually, I think it has a moral dimension, and here's how it is. Is even though most new inventions will bring almost as many problems as solutions, let's say you invent a hammer. So you suddenly have a hammer, and you can use that to kill somebody or to build a house. But the fact that you now have a new choice, which you did not have before, that new choice itself is a little bit of good that pushes it, tilts the balance in the favor of the good. And so we don't need much good to actually have progress, because if through technology we can create 1% more than we destroy with technology every year,
that's
that
a lot.
1%
cumulative,
1% compounded over time gives us progress.
Right.
So that's why there is a moral dimension to technology.
A positive moral dimension.
A positive moral dimension.
So, but I don't think you would say all progress is good, would you?
Yes.
You would.
Or are you just defining progress as things that are good? Or
right, exactly. I'm saying that there is an accumulation of good. We call that progress. But there's an accumulation of good.
Not merely motion forward, but actual improvement.
Right, and I would define those goods as in an evolutionary terms. I would say what we're accumulating over time, the good that we're accumulating over time, is the same good that we see in evolutionary history, which is increasing complexity, increasing diversity, increasing specialization, increasing mutualism, increasing evolvability. And so those things are accumulating over time, and that's actually what progress is.
Well, it sounds like you're equating technology to us. We are technology.
We certainly are. We don't really realize, but we have created ourselves. We're self-created. We began very early. As soon as we walked out of Africa, we invented with our minds cooking, which is an external stomach, which allowed us to It allowed us to digest food that we could not otherwise, and that additional nutrition changed the shape of our bodies. It reduced our teeth size. It moved our jaws. It altered our enzymes. So we're now dependent on long-term fertility for cooking, but we have actually re-engineered our bodies using our minds. And that's one of many ways in which we have altered ourselves. We're now, our genes are now evolving 100 times faster than they were 10,000 years ago. So we're biologically still accelerating. And that was the beginning of us inventing ourselves. And so we're not done yet.
At some level, we're a self-organized system. The molecules figured out through strange attractors or whatever how to start replicating and so on and so on. Do we, I don't even want to use the word risk here, but do we move to a point where we organize ourselves out of the equation and we exist as technology or technology moves on?
Well, but there's also a secondary corollary to that, which is that infinite growth is not sustainable. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there's this whole movement now to say, oh, slow down on the growth. So, I mean, I think it may be a false correlation to say progress is positive or progress is a good thing.
Right. I'm not equating progress with growth.
Okay.
Okay. So you know, it's like saying there's progress in evolution, but it's not like we make one huge bacteria and the bacterium keeps growing to the size of the planet.
The progress is towards organization. I mean, look, the world, the universe is winding down. Entropy is the norm. We are contrary to that winding down. We are by virtue of evolution or whatever, an organizing force.
Right, right. While the universe runs down, we are running up. And we have a self-organizing system which actually accelerates the creation of entropy as sort of the price to make local order or exotropy.
It's like CO2 as a consequence of life, yeah.
Exactly.
It's a side effect.
Exactly. And I think that what we are seeing over the long term is that as we move towards greater choices and possibilities, that is what we would call good. That's what we want. That's what we want for each other. That's what we want for our children. And so I think that that long-term self-organization is part of what we are. And at the same time, technology is selfish. I mean, the technium does have its own agenda. It has some autonomy. And so this tension between the fact that part of what we have made has its own agenda and we're still in it, well, is going to remain for us as long as we have technology. And 1,000 years from now, people will still be wrestling with the fact that, oh, technology seems to demand its due, it's doing things of its own, not completely, but partly. And all I have, and it also is serving us, it's good. And so I think that dual nature of ourselves is embedded in us. If you are self-created, that means you're both the creator and the created. That's the definition. So we are the first domestic. We are the first animals that we domesticated.
I love it. Huh. That's great.
I guess not counting bacteria and parasites.
Right, exactly.
We didn't do that on purpose.
Right.
So, when you say the technium has an agenda, I think the tendency might be to anthropomorphize that a little bit and jump to the conclusion that it's, you know, some sort of out of control robot monster like Skynet.
Too much sci-fi.
Or something like that. Yeah. What's an example of what you mean? Because in the book, you're very good at about explaining like how it's not that. It's not Skynet.
Right. It's not Skynet. It's there are a couple of examples we might think about. One would be that it has certain biases. Certain tendencies, and as an example of that, I would say suggest something like Moore's Law. Moore's Law is this phenomena where computer chips, that we're inventing computer chips at the rate where they double in density and half in price every 18 months, and they've been doing that for decades and decades. And when you plot that progress or that performance, it's an unwavering line. It's as straight as can be, and it turns out that line can't be changed even if you invest billions of dollars in trying to make it go faster. It turns out that those kinds of lines appear in other kinds of technologies, including bandwidth or performances of storage or DNA sequencing, all kinds of things. And it's almost as if that's sort of baked into the very nature of the system, because it's not just a self-fulfilling prophecy, because we know that by looking backwards, we can see that, in fact, it actually began earlier, even before people believed it was happening. And so there is a sense in which the technium wants that. And if probably, we don't know this, if we rewound the tape of life or technology and play it again, we would get Moore's Law again and again. And we can actually do some kinds of experiments on other prehistory, not experiments, but we can look at prehistory evidence where there was parallel technological development on different continents that were separated by the oceans before there was communications, and see that also they had the same similar kinds of technological development, suggesting again that there is a sense in which there is a tendency within the technium to drift towards certain sequence of events.
When I was reading that section where you're talking about how many people came up with evolution at the same time, how many people came up with electricity at the same time, and there's examples in calculus and other discoveries, I was wondering, do we even need a patent system to encourage innovation?
Wouldn't it be nice to get rid of that? Yeah.
Well, actually, I had a friend at a book reading. He said, if that is true, why should I even bother doing any work at all? Because I know someone else is going to do it.
We're all in parallel here. We're one massive.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, you created the concept of a hive mind. Is that what this is?
Well, that's, of course, I simultaneously discovered it with many other people at the same time.
I think you coined the term anyway.
Well, the hive mind is I think, another inevitable sequence in the history of technology. I think the internet and this idea of connecting all the minds together, kind of in the way that neurons connected the different cells in an emerging colony of cells, is inevitable. And it happens one time in every planet. And I think that we are alive at the moment on this planet when we are first hooking up everything to everything else. And I think it's an incredible time to be alive, because it only happens once in every planet's history. So, yes, I think that we are part of this technium. The technium is a kind of a hive mind, in the sense, as I explained earlier, that it's a system, that there's behavior that exists in the system that does not exist in any individual.
So what are the lessons for us and for our kids?
You know, I think there's several things. One is, when we are making or considering purchasing technology, there is a tendency to see this as of consumerism, as corporate-driven profiteering, as kind of trivial wastefulness, where lots of things that we are working on, inventing, buying, are transitory. They're ephemeral. They may be obsolete by something else.
I call it shiny crap. There's a lot of it.
Yeah, there's a lot of it. And one person's shiny crap is another person's pet project, right, and vice versa. But I actually think that we're doing something bigger by this. And I think that we should embrace this. And that is that every person out there, you and I, we have a different face and we have a different suite of talents and abilities. And that's often requires, those abilities often require a tool to help us discover it and share it. And I like to think of, Jimi Hendrix playing the guitar and amplifier and the genius that he brought to the world. And then to imagine him being born 200 years before the guitar amplifier, what a loss that would be.
Yeah.
And so I think that what we and you and I have is an obligation to bring to other people and to invent and discover these technologies, just as other people in previous generations have invented all the technology that you're now using in front of you, all that shiny crap.
Yeah.
And it's, and which is bringing out the best of you. And I think that those possibilities to share our genius is what technology brings us, those increasing choices and opportunities and possibilities and freedoms of choice. That's what technology gives us. And we can embrace this technology as not just delivering it to everybody in the world, but actually to see that we're part of something that began long ago, billions of years ago of self-organization is running through life, is running through us, and it's going to precede and run beyond us. And I think being part of that long arc, that long journey, is actually inspiring, and that we should embrace it with full arms.
Do you think that we go through cycles where, you know, we progress for a while and then we retrench and then we come back and we have to rediscover some things and catch back up and then go in leaps? Or do you think that's sort of a localized Western civilization view of things and everything globally actually does proceed rather uniformly?
Well, there is a hope, and I actually shared that hope, that maybe there are ways to leapfrog through some of the more primitive or unsatisfactory aspects of technology, like industrialization. Does everybody have to have factories that are polluting water, or does everybody have to have a period where everything's made out of concrete, or they're paving over cute country dirt roads? And I really wanted to believe that, but I couldn't find very many examples. The common example people say, well, look, you know, in the third world, they're using cell phones. They don't have to wait for copper wires strung throughout the country. They can just get cell phones. They've leaped frog telephone development. But in fact, and I thought that was a great idea, and I really thought, well, maybe that gives us hope that, you know, we could just sort of jump to fusion directly from, you know, wood burning campfires to fusion energy. We could just skip everything. But when I looked at the actual data for cell phones and landlines, actually what happens is the cell phones just precede landlines, that once there's enough cell phones in an area, they bring in the landlines to kind of carry more traffic, and or the internet or your movies or whatever else that's flowing over it. And that in fact, landlines haven't decreased at all, although cell phones certainly have increased much faster. So I'm open to the idea that maybe we can leapfrog, but it seems as if wherever that's been tried, that you can't, that you actually have to maybe go through it faster, but you actually have to have a kind of industrial base in order to have a digital culture. You know, I mean, it would be maybe wonderful to imagine a digital culture that didn't require industry, industrial base, but so far we haven't been able to do it.
So there's an inevitability to all of this.
I think there is. I think there's an inevitable sequence, a kind of, it's like a developmental sequence for an organism. You have to go through the fetus, the newborn, the toddler, the adolescence. That's just the sequence. It'd be kind of nice if you could just skip a couple of ones, but I don't think it works.
Ontogeny.
One of the ways we advance our industrial society is to exploit less advanced societies, though. If we run out of those less advanced societies, how do we get everyone forward?
Well, I think there's different scenarios, and I don't think we know the answer to that. And actually, I think that's one thing I do worry about technology is that we technology is, in a certain sense, if you map out the rise in prosperity, it's related to two things. It's related to a rise in population, and it's related to the rise in cheap energy that we've sucked from the ground.
Yeah. And that's a bill that's going to come due pretty soon.
Exactly. And so what it seems like we want is sort of cheap workers, cheap fuel. And in 2050 and beyond, when the human population starts to drop again, and of course, then who knows where peak oil is.
Why is it going to drop?
Because in every single country of the world where development has come in, the fertility has dropped and dropped drastically.
That's actually very hopeful, isn't it?
Well, it is.
Population is ultimately the problem.
Well, no, actually, I think what we have in history is we have no historical record of anywhere where there was rising living standards, progress, without rising population. We have lots of cases where rising population brought poverty, but we have no places where progress came with sinking population. Now, it's possible that we could imagine or invent an economy where every year there were less, you had a smaller market, you had smaller audience, you had fewer workers. It's possible that we we'll have to do that and invent that. But it's really hard to imagine how that works.
Robots?
Exactly. That's what people say is robot slaves. You have cheap energy, you have cheap artificial minds, and that they become that source that every prosperity in the past has sort of sat on, which is kind of slave labor.
You really surprised me, Kevin, because I would have thought somebody with your background and tradition would have been gloomy about the future and almost, I mean, it seems like it's so easy to be concerned about we're going to run out of energy, we're going to overpopulate. It sounds like you're saying that the future is bright.
I think I have been convinced by history that if you take certainly the last 200 years, and I would buy Julian Simon's prognosis on this, although I don't agree with everything it says, but then the last 200 years, you know, basically the things that we care about most have been increasing in terms of humans' point of view. I think we do have a serious issue about the environment. We need to repair that in order to kind of move forward. There is a period that we're coming up to where we really have to make our technology more green. But what's interesting, and I think very, very important, is that we have not discovered a technology so far that we were unable to invent a greener version of it, which suggests to me that there's nothing inherent in technology that's incompatible with life. That's inherently compatible with life because, of course, it is an extension of it. And so that gives us, I think, tremendous hope that we can actually, again, further this kind of facet of technology that is more humane, that is more organic and less industrial.
It's easy to get lost. When we're living our lives, we're looking up very closely at human history. It's hard to take that step back and look and see.
We don't have the perspective at all.
The spread of what has actually happened over thousands of years.
Yeah.
And I think that's what I'm trying to do is, you know, we tend to think of technology as one thing after another without any kind of framework for it or any kind of placement in the cosmos or a longer view. And I'm trying to step back from the next quarter, from the next year, and say, hey, if we step back really far, we can see that actually we're part of something much greater than us, this long arc through life, through history, this self-organization, and that when we do so, we actually can play, we can be part of something bigger than ourselves.
How do we get off that treadmill, though, of looking from quarter to quarter? Because that's what drives our economy now is what are your short-term gains and what do the stockholders get out of it? And we don't care about sustainability, I feel like, because of that focus. How do we break out of that?
There's been a lot of talk about trying to institute a third bottom line or other ways of measuring these other important things. And I think unless they are measured, we're not going to pay attention to them. So I really promote the idea of inventing new metrics to add to the dashboard to gauge how well we're doing so that we can actually try to do them better. So as long as I think they're kind of vague and unarticulated, I think we will have trouble. So I think we can find ways to add, to quantify them, and think and to ask the right questions and give good definitions, which I think do matter in the long run.
You have to get everybody to agree to that sustainability as valuable to make those metrics matter.
But it'll just happen because the technium is going to move us there.
I think the technium is moving in that direction, is biased in those directions, is biased to increase diversity.
Could we screw it up?
Yes, I think it's possible to, Fermi's paradox, the fact that we haven't seen any other intelligent life in the universe might suggest
maybe they screwed it up.
maybe, Kevin, you're just looking at one little narrow slice of history. And if you look at the history of the universe, that ain't so positive.
The anthropomorphic principle.
That is one of the possibilities.
We're here because we survived, but maybe we're the only ones.
Yeah, it's very hard to tell what that means. But what's interesting that I think while we await contact with alien intelligences, I think we're going to we're going to inevitably create an alien intelligence here on Earth with AI and stuff. And that, to me, is the value.
That's a good point.
Of those intelligences is that they're alien.
They're
different.
Alien.
There's really no reason to make a human intelligence.
You can't. We can make, you probably can't.
Well, we can make one in 9 months in a much better way.
Yeah, that's more efficient. But, you know, you look at people like Jeff Hawkins trying to create memory chips that work like the human mind. That's probably not what's going to happen. I once asked Ray Kurzweil, would a sentient computer be a human? He said, well, what does it matter if you can't tell the difference? Doesn't matter.
Yeah, but I think there's no reason to. I think much more valuable to us is actually to create other kinds of thinking.
Right.
Because I believe that actually we're not going to solve the mysteries of the universe unless we have different types of minds working kind of in concert so that they can think of things that we simply would never be able to think on our own. But we can maybe at least make other minds that could think about things that we couldn't think of.
How do we, in that instance, differentiate between moving ourselves into becoming the machines and having the machines serving us? Is there a difference? Does it just all blend together?
I think it is blend together. I think it's like nature, nurture. How do you unravel what our genes cause versus what the environment causes? And it's like, how do we unravel us from what we have made? We're self-created. And so I think this tension between the things that we make and the things that we are is going to forever be just wrapped up in us. And we will have less of a distinction between where we begin, where we end, and more of a sense that, well, we're already cyborgian. I mean, we're already, you know, created as a technology. And so we're more so, and we're not going to unravel that. I think that's an unnecessary unraveling. I think we have a necessary paradox in our own being.
Yeah, as we create DNA computing and take tips from neurons on how to route better, how to create more biological-like skin grafts, and at the same time we're adding artificial limbs and things, it may end up that you just can't tell who's the robot and who's the human.
Yeah, that's the Battlestar Galactica version. And
right.
I think... The wonderful thing about that is I love the idea that it was the robots who were more religious than than the humans.
Yeah, they were more devout.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, they said
they were the monotheists.
You guys screwed it up.
You had too many gods. That was the problem.
Yeah.
Nuts. Yeah, no, so I think we will be confronted with, I think one of the things that technology is doing right now is that every time there's a new invention in, say, computers or AI or even genetics, it really challenges our idea of who humans are, of what humans are here for and what we're doing. And I think that's a really big question. We're kind of like on a permanent identity crisis, and it's only going to get worse. But more importantly, because we've invented ourselves and aren't done yet, are having to define who we want to be, not just who we are, but who we're going to be. And we have really no process at all for deciding that, of where it is that we want humanity to go.
Should we?
So
do we need
far.
One?
Well, we're going somewhere. It might be, you know.
It'd be nice to steer. Grab the wheel.
Or even to look at where we're going.
But isn't that kind of contrary to the idea of the technium knowing what it wants? And
well, here's the thing is I don't think there's a single thing. It's not like we're moving to some omega endpoint, some utopian single arrogant endpoint. It's multiple. It's like an explosion moving out. We're probably going to be many different answers to that question, just as cause that's where it's going. It's increased diversity, increased opportunities. It's increased varieties of us. But nonetheless, we need to look ahead.
Yeah.
Do we even remain individuals? Is that something that's even important?
Are you an individual on Facebook at this moment?
Maybe not. We're part of a stream, a live stream.
I did a search for Tom Meritz earlier, and there was
quite a few.
Them. Yeah.
Yeah. There ain't no. That's interesting. So to answer the question, and by the way, we should reiterate, we're talking to Kevin Kelly, the author of a new book, And you had a website, the Technium. Yeah, there he's holding up his own book. You had a website, the Technium, where you kind of used the hive mind to help write the book. It is now out. It is from Viking, What Technology Wants. And you answer it kind of in the last pages. I mean, you're saying technology wants what life wants plus. Is that right? Have I misstated it?
If you could repeat that, because I...
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you just were flare. So stunned by what I said.
The Technium didn't want you to hear that.
The Technium said, no, don't tell Kevin what we want. The The Technium or technology wants what life wants, but more, kind of.
Exactly. I think where it's headed, what technology wants is us to explore the possible ways to evolve. What the Technium is doing is the sort of the latest instantiation, the latest version of exploring the ways to explore, of learning the ways to learn, of creating the ways to create. And so we're in the Technium, as part of the Technium, we're involved in actually filling up the universe with possible ways of learning, of being, of investigating and creating new things. And I think it wants to be more of itself, which is learning, adapting, mindfulness, all those good things. So think about all the good things about life on the planet, and what the Technium wants is more of that.
Hmm. Boy, I hope you're right.
Getting back to...
I hope it doesn't want robots with red lights going up and down their back. That's all I'm saying.
Maybe that's a good thing.
More toasters.
But tying that back into our early conversation about the Amish, who sort of, in my mind, take it a little too far in their selection of... they're a little too conservative about holding
narrow.
The line.
Yeah.
How do we embrace technology, try things out, see what works for us without getting caught up into that unsustainable forward motion and take advantage of all of this good that can come out of it?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question about what I would call techno-literacy. I mean, I think what we're having to learn is not like how to ride a bicycle, how to drive a car, but how to actually deal with the fact that the technology we have tomorrow does not even exist today, and we're going to be on this never-ending escalator of new stuff, and that we sort of learn how to surf along this wave of new things that are coming along. And I think we don't have a lot of those skills right now. We have to understand that we're always a newbie, that every new technology will bring new problems, that they're actually we do require sabbaticals. You know, we have a sabbatical from work. In religious traditions, teach, you know, take off one day a week. It's not because they're saying work is bad, it's horrible. No, they're saying work is good. It's so good that you actually want to take a break from it. And I think taking sabbaticals and jubilees from our technological environment is a good habit. And so I think there's lots of kind of practical skills that we're going to learn to deal with this new platform, which is just the Technium itself, mastering the idea that, okay, well, you know, new stuff is coming. Whatever I bought today is going to be obsolete tomorrow. We just have to get over that. And other kinds of aptitudes and skills, and learning to, you know, to say, well, I've tried that. Okay, I don't need that. That's not necessary in my life. I can let it go and not feel bad. I actually think that we'll get better at that.
KK.org, that's Kevin's website, and this book gives you lots of choices. You can get it in hardcover, but you can also get it on Kindle, and there's an Audible edition, which is what I'll be doing, listening to the Audible edition of this, What Technology Wants. Any final thoughts, Kevin, before we say goodnight to you?
You know, I think it's important that we remember that there is good in the world, and that the technology can actually help us bring it forward, and that we should maybe engage with technology as much as possible as a way to steer it, and rather than kind of like, maybe put it this way, you know, if I had a stupid idea, the response to my stupid idea would not be for you to think less or for me to think less, but to have a better idea. And I think the same thing about technology. The response to a stupid technology or bad technology is not less technology, but better technology.
I love it.
So so let's have some better technologies and better ideas.
Yeah.
Thanks for your interest. Okay.
Great to talk to you, Kevin. Really great to talk to you. Kevin Kelly, KK.org. Take care. Have a great night. You obviously never stop being an optimist.
No, I can't. I've got that really bad disease in Asia.
Great talking to you, Kevin.
I'm glad it's catching. Take care, Kevin. Good night.
Right.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
It's not at all what I expected.
No?
I thought he would be saying, oh, man, technology's leading us down the road to hell and ruin.
Yeah. It's not that simple of a message.
No.
Yeah.
But it's ultimately positive.
Yeah, definitely.
Very positive. Yes, we want to steer, but it's almost as if what technology wants is fundamentally beneficial for life. I mean, it's good.
It's almost like, yes, technology can lead us down that road to hell if we don't listen to it.
Right. There you go. I like that. Really good.
Yeah. You feel more optimistic now?
No.
No?
I'm just a grim, gloomy kind of guy. Well, it's funny. You know, I hold both, you know. And certainly we love technology. We wouldn't be doing all this technology coverage. But I feel like the reason that motivated me to get into this was I love it, but I also have a great fear of what it can do unchecked. And I feel like, I guess ultimately I've always said we should steer it because I felt like it's always been kind of neutral. And so it's up to us to determine its polarity. But I guess he's saying it's naturally positive as long as we don't screw it up.
Yeah. We are the ones who can make it.
We're
negative.
The problem.
Yeah. I totally agree with that.
Yeah. Are you an optimist?
I think most of the time I'm a cynical optimist.
Yeah. I'd say that's exactly where I stand.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cynical optimist. The glass is, well, it's kind of, you know.
The glass is half full, but it's still only half full.
And why is that? Enough. Yeah, yeah. We really do enjoy doing these shows. We thank you. I went to the back of Kevin's book, and you saw me doing that. I know, Tom. And he had all these people that he interviewed for the book and thanked them. And I realized these are all the people we want to get on the show.
Absolutely.
So I've marked for you, Eileen. You have a job. Chris Anderson, Gordon Bell, Stuart Brand, Richard Dawkins, Eric Drexler, Brian Eno, Paul Hawken, Danny Hillis, Ray Kurzweil, Jaron Lanier, Nathan Mervold, Howard Rheingold, Paul Sappho, Sherry Turkle, Werner Vinge. Wouldn't he be great?
Oh, yeah.
Is he still alive? I think he is.
Yes. I'm going to say yes.
I'm going to say yes. I can hear Eileen laughing in the other room. I just love that. I'm just going to, on the new studio, we're going to have a little Eileen mic.
Yeah.
And just sweeten it. We're going to sweeten the sound.
Sweeten he's still alive. He's still alive.
He is. Good. He'd be great to talk to.
Yeah.
Science fiction author and kind of hero of people like, Kurt Vonnegut. And Vonnegut talks about Vinge a lot. Very, very interesting.
Born in Wisconsin.
Well, that means you two would bond. Midwestern boys.
Right, right.
Jared Diamond. Let's add that to the list. Absolutely. You know, Zephyr quoted Collapse, and I thought that was very interesting. Had I read Collapse, I read Guns, Germs, and Steel, but I hadn't read Collapse yet. And had I read Collapse, maybe there would be something to talk about there. Alan Kay, let's put him on the list.
Yeah.
I've been trying to get Alan Kay on the show for years. In fact, because he's a small talk guy, I know Randall Schwartz has been. I'm writing this in the book. These are people that he should have thanked.
I'm going to add to your acknowledgments, sir. I'm not sure why you left this out, but I'm going to.
Yeah, yeah.
After Eileen's done using it to book, we can send it back to him for the revision.
And by the way, next edition, can you please include our thoughts? Eno is on the back, actually. He says, unparalleled in both depth and breadth, this book is set to become a landmark in modern thinking. The reason I want to interview Brian Eno is we interviewed him on the Screensavers, and he autographed and gave me his latest CD, which was really incredible, Bells. It was all different kinds of bells. And Allison Strawn, Silicon Alley, stole it.
So you need to get it again.
I got to get Brian Eno on so I can get his autograph again.
Right, right. That's funny.
She stole it.
Allison stole it?
Well, she said she borrowed it, but I've never seen it again.
I have her copy of Windows 98 still.
There you go. How did you get that?
She loaned it to me. She said, this is my personal copy. I needed it for a segment. She's like, this is my personal copy. I want it back.
And you never gave it
back? And it was one of those things where I stamped it on my mind, like, got to give this back to Allison. And just, she never asked for it. And I kept forgetting to bring it back into work.
Well, good. Maybe we can do a hostage
swap. I had a book like that called Gulcher that a guy at Half Price Books in Austin lent to me in 1993 and said, I want this back. I kept it with me all of these years, saw him again in Austin at South by Southwest in March and gave it to him. He's like, I forgot this book existed, much less that you had mine.
I have a Patrick Norton paperback that he also said, whatever you do, this is one of my most treasured possessions. It was, I think it was a Philip K. Dick novel or something like that. And the cover fell off.
Ooh.
So I just never gave him back to him.
He has my Harry Potter DVDs. One of my most treasured possessions.
But we got to find a bridge. You and I will be on one end. Allison and Patrick can be on the other end.
Right.
And we'll walk to the middle. We'll carefully place our items on the ground. We'll swap them and it'll be great.
Exactly.
Maybe in Berlin. All right, good. We're done.
All right.
We recorded this. Do I need to do anything with it? Do we put these out?
Yeah, we've been putting them in the specials feed. I know that. So is there billboards or anything?
I don't know what the hell I'm doing.
Eileen?
Do you know what number this is, Eileen? Is it a Twit special number, should I say? She sounds just like me. I don't know.
Right.
Make it up. 44.
49.
This is Twit special number 49, recorded October nothing.